Okay, 8:31. Hello, everyone. It's May 24th. Good to be back after, hope you all had a good Shavuos. Lots of emails and things from people listening. I'll go for about 15 minutes. Whatever I don't get to this class, we'll get to in future classes. First, I want to call your attention to this book, if you've seen it. Hold on, let me open up my other screen here. Rabbi Aaron Adler, who has given classes on Torah in Motion, just came out with a book called 70 Conversations in Transit with Rabbi Soloveitchik. So why am I mentioning this to you? Because we spoke about the Brisker method. I think it was last class. And I raised the issue, well, could you have truth that isn't historical truth? That is, you give an explanation that really isn't what the Rambam had in mind. Can it still be valuable and Torah truth? And I think I mentioned that I'm doing an article on this, and I'm going to give all sorts of sources. Well, on page 72 here, he records that after one of the Rav's 4-hour Yortzeit shiurim, he says, packed with sensational chidushim, interpreting the Rambam, he says, listen to this. I asked the Rav if he really believed that the Rambam had all these great ideas in mind when he wrote his book. The Rav looked at me and said, quote, what's the difference? Was it not a good shiur? I was somewhat stunned by the answer. The next morning, in conversing with the Rav's son, Rabbi Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, he told me that it is perfectly legitimate to use a text, halachic or otherwise, to launch ideas. Irrespective of whether or not the Rambam entertained these ideas, the very ideas themselves must be considered authentic Torah and treated as such. So that raises the interesting issue we spoke about. Something could be true, small t, but that doesn't mean that's what the author had in mind. That is, you can give a chidush, and it has independent value, and you reach a point where it's really not that relevant whether the Rambam had this in mind, as long as the ideas can be developed out of it, according to the Brisker approach, as reflected by the Rav. Also, just as interesting, as I was going through the book on page 76 and 77, he quotes that Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Adler, worked at a conservative synagogue with their Hebrew junior congregation, and the Rav supported this. And the Rav said that for children to come on Shabbos, unlike Ramosha, it's not a problem, because it's not like conversion where everything, it's all or nothing. That with Kirov, it's done it in small doses. He says that, he quotes Ramosha here, that Ramosha had a different opinion. But then he says, he quotes Rav Schechter as saying that the Rav forbid rabbis from inviting adult congregants to Shabbos meals. And Rabbi Adler, he wants to say maybe there's a difference between children and adults. But if you read the way he described the Rav, that about the purpose of Kiruv, it's hard not to see what the Rav told him as in contradiction to what Rav Schechter said, because there's no difference when it comes to Kiruv of children or adults. But and while I'm on this, one of the people emailed about, we spoke about going into conservative shul, and someone actually asked, well, what about if like you have to go there for family reasons or something? Actually, if it's Rav Schechter mentions this, it's in Divrei Harav, page 157. And he says as follows, that there was a family in Detroit that went to a conservative synagogue. The son became religious and he went to yeshiva. But his brother was having a bar mitzvah in a conservative synagogue. Many of us have had this experience with relatives. And he asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Soloveitchik said, daven beforehand and go there and sit there, because it's important for family ties. And then he says at the end, this son who had the bar mitzvah, he too ended up going to yeshiva and becoming a Ben Torah Amiti. And you can imagine that if the son who's in yeshiva didn't go to the brother's bar mitzvah, you can be sure the parents' reaction would have been that this is a fanaticism. You think they would have sent their 13-year-old son to yeshiva? No, they would have seen that it's, these yeshivas turn out fanatics. So the Rav's position was that for family reasons, that this is an important thing to do. Remember, the Rav said you can't even go into the shul to hear tikias haShofar. So it's interesting that this image that people have that he was absolutely opposed under all circumstances, we see it's really not the case. There was enough exceptions. Let me share a screen here. Just to follow up, if you remember a few weeks ago, more than a few weeks ago, I told you about this case in Long Island where the Vod said that not to, go to a new Hechsher. And lo and behold, if you read the New York Post, look at this. It made the New York Post yesterday. Long Island rabbis accused of mafia-like methods in kosher turf battle because one of the people who the rabbi said don't eat there because they used a different hashgacha, suing them in court. By the way, he got a, I don't know if this is a reliable based in or not, in Lakewood, he got a heter to go to secular court because the Vada Kashrus of the five towns has 53 rabbis. I know a few of them. None of them refused to apparently appear before this based in. And it's an interesting case. I don't know if Nat Lewin's with us tonight to talk about it, the First Amendment, because on the one hand, the Vod's lawyers say that the lawsuit is without merit because, of course, the rabbis have an obligation and a right under the First Amendment to guide their followers in religious issues. And if you read the article that spoke about it, the Vod is clear that it has nothing really to do with the kashrus of this organization per se, the new one, but they think it's important to have one kashrus in the entire city. So I don't see how this really gets started as a lawsuit, but at Baston, I can see it. But on the other hand, you can't just say, let's say you say don't eat with someone because the kashrus is no good. Does that mean you can never sue? I don't know. It would seem not. Because the rabbis can claim it's they're doing their religious due diligence. But we'll see what happens with that. We had a case like this in my town. I support this. I think it's important. If there's one Vod, and you want to keep the standards, it's important to have it. So we had a restaurant in our town and where they took the hashgacha off. They didn't tell you why. Obviously, there was issues here. And within 2 days, they have a new hashgacha from Passaic, one of the Haredim hashgacha. So fine, I believe in supporting. And the rabbi said, don't eat in this place. And it was closed within like 2 months because of myself and lots of other people, most people wouldn't go there in the name of communal loyalty, that if the rabbis say not to, we don't want to have another hashgacha coming in, even if it's a very reputable hashgacha, it should be just the Vod. The problem with me was that I'll reveal something, although I don't know, some people know, I had a gift certificate I got a gift certificate, $200 from my parents, and I had used 70, and I had like $130. So the problem was I didn't want to wait money to go to waste. So let's say the hashgacha from the Vod was gone on Sunday, and by Tuesday you had the new hashgacha. So I figured, okay, I won't eat there, but I have to use my gift certificate. And so I go to the restaurant, and I use a reputable Haredi rabbi from Passaic, but I still wanted to know what's going in the kitchen. And what I'm going to tell you now, you probably have heard stories like that. I go into the kitchen, and who's in the kitchen? Let's say this is Wednesday or Tuesday. The same, again, when you have a hashkacha, it's under the company or the Vod or whatever. But then you have a mashkiach tamidi. The one who makes sure everything is done properly is the mashkiach tamidi. Lo and behold, the same mashkiach tamidi under the guy from the rabbi from Passaic was the same one from the Vod. It was the exact same thing. The kitchen was the exact same thing. The mashkiach was the exact same thing. Nothing had changed. So it's just who was paying a salary. Was it the Hashkacha organization at Passaic, or was it the local Hashkacha organization? But okay, I still get it that you got to support the local thing. So I got my food, I finished up my gift certificate, and I never was seen in the restaurant again. A few of you emailed me. Oh, a couple more things here. One of you from Brooklyn, Mordechai from Brooklyn. He sent me, we spoke about mitzvah tants. So look what he sent me. And then you'll find interesting the story about this. I don't know if many people know this situation. First, let me show you the mitzvah tants. We spoke about the mitzvah tants, and I gave the example of mitzvah tants because anyone who tells you there's no mixed dancing, it's not true. You have plenty of mixed dancing. Here's mixed dancing. So what's going on here? I'm going to explain why this is a religious Zionist wedding. I'll explain to you what the guy, the chassan, with the strimal is. You might not know that it's a religious Zionist Hasidic Rebbe. But first, watch the mitzvah tants, and then I'll tell you about this family. It's an incredible story, or very interesting, I should say. Actually, hold on, I got to share the sound here. Let me share the sound with you. If you haven't heard about this, you'll find it interesting. So, but here's the mitzvah tants, mixed dancing, but only for the bride and groom. Okay, so if you know the strimals there, you can see it's the ones that go up like that, let's say from the Rishon dynasty. What are we talking about here? What's, well, have any of you ever heard of this this rabbi? Let me show you. Shake it out of the screen here. Hold on a second. Hold on, I gotta get out of the screen here. It's Pashkan, they call it, the dynasty. But the very strange situation. Here's the Rebbe, the previous Rebbe. His name was Rav Yisrael Friedman. But the story's so strange, because here he is. He's actually was a professor in Jewish history. Then he became a Rosh Hashiva, and then he became the Admor of Pashkan. He's descended from all the Rebbes, and he's the son-in-law of one of the Vizhnitzer Rebbe. But when he married his wife, they moved to a Shomer Hatzair kibbutz, and that's where they lived. And if you read the stories, that supposedly they were religious there. I don't know if this is even possible. I mean, what are you supposed to eat? Even if you're a vegetarian, how do you eat in the kibbutz? The kalim aren't kosher. So here you have, maybe they're covering it up. Maybe he wasn't religious in all those years, but they say he was. But he was involved in the Shomer Hatzair, and then he and his wife, the daughter of the Vizhnitzer Rebbe, they live on the Shomer Hatzair kibbutz for all these years. And he was the Rebbe, and he became a Rebbe for the religious Zionist. And just... Here's another. I'll show you a picture of him, a video of him. He had tishes. So you see, it's a religious Zionist crowd there. Then he died a couple years ago, and who was succeeded by the new Rebbe, the one you saw on the video, they're dancing. He's a general in the Israeli army, religious Zionist. But once he became the Rebbe, then he wears the strimal, and he's the new Rebbe. So you have a Rebbe now, and I know one person who goes to him. You know, he considers himself a chassid of him. So he's a general, but now I guess he's retired. So he's a Rebbe. He's a Hasidic Rebbe with the whole, for the religious Zionists. We know that there are many religious Zionists who are interested. They're looking for Hasidus, for Neo-Hasidus, all those things. Okay, in next class, I'll speak about the Machokas in Tells, the fighting in Tells, because I have some more videos and people ask me, is it really much different than happened in Tells? So let me hold off on that till next class. Let me make a note of this here. And Joel Mandelbaum, I'll get to what I told you I'd say next class when I deal with Ponovich. Again, and Rabbi Kahneman. The last thing I want to mention is correction from one of our Chabad people. I mentioned that I was in Tzivos Hashem when I was in camp. And really, he was paying attention that Tzivos Hashem began in 1980, and I was in camp in the 70s. So I guess technically I wasn't in Tzivos Hashem, but we were in something where they gave us we had like a whole group we were in with a folder, and we were signed up, and that's how they had my name, if you remember. On my bar mitzvah, they wished me a happy bar mitzvah. And then I said that we sang about Mashiach. If I said we sang, we want Mashiach now, that's a mistake. I didn't remember saying that. That's not was the song. Let me preserve for posterity. I remember this. This is from 1975. So I remember this 46 years ago. This was the song we sang. We didn't sing We Want Mashiach Now, which apparently I'm told by the Chabad guy comes in the 80s. This was the song. I only remember the first verse. If anyone remembers the other verses, let me know. This is how it went. And it's, at least I recall it from being a Chabad. I'm certain. I also went to Pirche with Aguda, and I'm certain it's not Pirche. It was Chabad. Goodbye, America. Goodbye, assimilation. Mashiach is coming to build a Jewish nation. And then there were more lines to it. But that was the song I remember from my youth. Not We Want Mashiach Now. Goodbye, America. Goodbye, assimilation. Mashiach is coming to build a Jewish nation. I was in Pirche a bit. I went to the Borough Park once. You had to learn Mishnayos by heart. So we go to Borough Park, and all you had to do was learn one parak. And there were some kids there who knew like a whole Seder of Mishnayos by heart. Later, I was told that some of the Gedolim, I think even Rav Yoshev, thought this was a waste of time. But better to learn one parak and understand it, just memorize it by heart. But that's what we used to do. Okay, everyone, let us return to what we're going to do. We're going back to Hungarian Orthodoxy. We were speaking a bit about Rabbi Greenwald. Rabbi Nachum Shmaryahu, a Chabadnik, one more thing, I'll just say it. He agrees, what I said is correct. Well, he doesn't agree, he's Chabad. The Kohanim do not go to the kever of the Rebbe. So they didn't go to the Rayatz either. In other words, they don't hold to the idea that a Kohen is, that a Kohen can be, it's not Matame by Yitzadi. So we spoke about Rabbi Greenwald. And I told you, interestingly enough, that he served as at the end of his life, his synagogue, he was very, if you look in Adam Furziger's book, forgot the name, the last book, chapter 1, page 26, he speaks about it. There was a shul called Agudas Achim, which had mixed seating, and Rabbi Greenwald went to war against it. But then his own synagogue, Beth Jacob, when they built a new building, they demanded that they adopt mixed seating. And in the end, they agreed to compromise. No machitza, but separate seating. So even Rabbi Greenwald had to deal with this. What I forgot to show you last class, it was on the screen the whole time, but I forgot, is this letter, which I discovered in YIVO from Professor Marvin Fox, who I knew from Brandeis University. It's a letter to Chaim Bloch, well-known forger and other things. We don't need to get into that now. But he tells the story that after Rabbi Greenwald died, Marvin Fox at this time was teaching, and he's a Musmach from Skokie, but he was teaching at Ohio State in Columbus, how Rabbi Greenwald asked Marvin Fox to be Maspid him, not any of the local rabbis. I don't know why. But then he talks about Rabbi Greenwald had maybe the largest collection of letters from great rabbis in America, historical scholars, everything he had. And these would be very valuable. And Marvin Fox records that the wife and the children burnt it all. A terrible, terrible loss. Quite apart from that, he had a huge collection of books, one of the largest private collections in America. What happened to that? Fox tells the story that what did they do? The widow, together with her son, decided to give the books to Hebrew Union College. He says, and I oppose this also. I said that it's forbidden to give holy books of a Talmud Chacham and Reish Hamayim to a Reform institution where they degrade the Torah. But the widow said that the HUC helped her husband in his work, and therefore she gave it all to him. It's a strange stoic thing there, but this is how Hebrew Union College has one of the great collections of responsa literature, rabbinic literature, because they got the Greenwald Library. And I heard from someone else the story. Rabbi Greenwald was in Columbus, every time he needed a book, he just called up on the phone and they sent the book from Cincinnati. And his wife saw that he couldn't have done any of his work and the Hebrew College was anything he needed, they would send to him. And therefore she felt that she should reward them for that. But if you go to HUC today, I've been there one time, you can see the Sfarim from Rav Yekusiel Greenwald. We're picking up with in the Sefer now. I introduced you last class to the Hungarian situation. We're up to page, let's see, page 349, Siman Kuf Samach Hei. I introduced the issue of Orthodox and status quo and Neolog. I mentioned Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. If you look in this book, Shemesh Merapet, number 93, it's the letter that I mentioned, where if Shimshon Raphael Hirsch sends a letter to a Rabbi Goitein in Hungary saying that it's okay if the community doesn't want to join the Orthodox and wants to be status quo, as long as the community is Shomer Torah and Mitzvos, what's the difference? That's fine. Although Hirsch must have recognized this was going to create problems because he said to the rabbi, don't publicize my opinion. But from Hirsch's standpoint, you can't compel people to belong to an organization, even though that's exactly what the Maram Chick and others said. So we spoke all about that. I mentioned, I explained the whole situation. One thing I didn't mention is that we even have one case where you had an Orthodox group that were members of the Neologs. How did that happen? It happened in the city of Munkacs. Munkacs, which is run by the Munkacs Rebbe, or Chaim Elazar Shapiro, a big extremist, anti-Zionist, but the controversy I'm going to speak about had nothing to do with anti-Zionism, because the Belzers were also anti-Zionists. But the Belzers, in the interwar years, the Belzer Rebbe settled in Munkacs, and he was persecuted by the Munkacs Rebbe. Instead of calling them, the Munkacs would call the Hasidim of Belz, not Hasidei Belz, Chazirei Belz. You know, pigs of Belz, terrible stuff. And then after the Belzer Rebbe died, the Munkacs Hasidim said, we cannot stay in this community because the Munkacs was also the Rav of the community. So they wanted to form a status quo community, but for whatever reason, the government didn't allow it. So in the city of Munkacs, Mukachevo, it's in the Ukraine today, the Belzer Hasidim they declared themselves Neolog. And what did the Munkacs Rebbe said? Well, they're no different than any other Neolog. All Neologs are reformers, and therefore you can't daven with them. You can't do anything. But the Belzers in Munkacs were officially Neolog. If you go to Budapest today, one of the Chabad shuls is technically a Neolog shul. So I guess if you're Hungarian Orthodox, you can't step foot in it because it's a cherem on stepping foot in it. But what happened was after the war, none of this meant anything. And Lubavitch was able to take over a shul. But technically, it's Neolog. That is recognized that way from the government. There could be some money distributions. There are certain things about an Orthodox synagogue that you would have. For instance, you could have at a status quo, a choir, for instance. The Chazan could wear the gowns. There were decrees that were made, a number of decrees made by the Hungarian Orthodox that to be an Orthodox synagogue, you could not do it. You couldn't have a wedding in the synagogue. If you go to the Kaczynski show in Budapest, you see the chuppah is in the back of the show. There was a number of decrees that were instituted. You couldn't have a preacher in the vernacular in an Orthodox synagogue. These were all things that you could not have. So you could have them in the status quo. Remember, I said status quo shuls became basically like modern Orthodox type of shuls. So we're up to now Siman Kuf Samachet. I introduced you to this Rabbi Ben Sion Jakobovitz. The title of the responsum is The Approach of Separatism of the Rabbis of Hungary. And basically, I wrote to him. He has a whole two volumes all about the Hungarian approach, how the separatist approach is the proper way. And I said to him, well, you know, this isn't our approach. Why? He makes it seem as if you don't follow his approach, you're not a good Jew. I said, in Poland, they never did this, and Lithuania never did this. I said, that's not what me and my friends and my people, we don't believe in this sort of separatism. And it's a long polemical letter against what I said. And we spoke about the Netziv in the classes. The Netziv has a famous responsum about this, that we fight among ourselves. Of course, we fight the irreligious. But when we deal with the non-Jews, we go together as one. We saw this in my town on Sunday. We had a rally against the, in support of Israel. And it was signed by the Orthodox rabbis, the Chabad rabbis, and the conservative rabbis also, and even two Reform synagogues, but one Reform synagogue actually backed out. I'm told they thought that it would be too pro-Israel. That is, you deal with the reformers, you have all the mishigas that they have. That's perfectly in line with the Netziv's approach, the Rav Soloveitchik's approach, with the Lithuanian approach, that in dealing with anti-Semitism and things like that, we join together with the non-Orthodox. But internally, of course, we have to fight about these things, and we don't give legitimacy to the other side, etc. So he says, "What that your people say they hold by the view of the Netziv, that's a sign that they don't know what they're talking about." He says, "Because I explained clearly in Volume 2 that in Lithuania, the Maskilim, who the Netziv was speaking about, they were still at least publicly Torah observant, and therefore they were able to fool the Netziv and make him think that they were still good Jews." And that's why he had this approach. It could be he's right. I don't know. It could be that that's why the Netziv, because he at least saw these traditionalist Maskilim, that's why he could say that. When you look at the followers in the Netziv, in the next generation, Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik, they didn't have this approach at all. They didn't care if it was Reform Jews. Rav Soloveitchik has a famous essay in which he says that in the Holocaust, the blood of the Bundists and the Zionists and the Orthodox, were shed together. So I'd like to think that the Netziv, it wouldn't matter to the Netziv, what type of Jew, even a sinning Jew, it doesn't matter if we're dealing with matters of Jewish communal concern. What's the difference? We were together, and definitely by the early part of the 20th century, even in Lithuania and Poland, the big cities were controlled by the irreligious. Every one of the and every town and city, you had one Jewish community where you had the non-religious, you had Bundists, you had socialists, you had Zionists, you had labor Zionists, revisionists, together with the Orthodox. It was one community. They had one rabbi. They did it all together, and they all assumed that this is the approach of the Gedolei Yisrael of Lithuania, including the Netziv. And so whether the Netziv would have had a different opinion, like he says, it's really neither here nor there, because this was always the approach of the great rabbis in Lithuania and Poland, unlike in Hungary and in Germany. That's where he had the great feud between Rabbi Hirsch and Rabbi Bamberger that we've spoken about. And then he goes on how bad these people that the Netziv was so friendly with, what did they do in the end? They destroyed his great yeshiva Volozhin, which we know is not true. The Maskilim did not destroy the yeshiva Volozhin. Usually they'll tell you that it's because of the secular studies that the Maskilim got the government to institute, but we know it's not true. We've spoken about it. And then he says that if you look around, listen to this, and you see Hayom Yiddishkeit, that's what it says here, Yiddishkeit, the whole Kitzei Teva, you see Judaism throughout the whole world, this is all due to Yehudei Ungarn. This is only because of Hungarian Orthodoxy. So if anyone's wondering why in your local towns you have yeshivas and you have kosher food and everything, he's telling us it's all because of Hungarian Orthodoxy. Whatever. So he quotes someone else who says that. But then he says, but you know what? Your group, I don lekafschus. I'm judging them favorably because Russia yeshivot, that is in the Litvish world, Lobikin Yudit. These Russian yeshiva, they don't know Jewish history of the Hamei HaKodemet. They don't know what happened in the 19th century. He says, Adrabba, but if they are really Erel Chayidin, they should learn my books, and then they'll see why they're misguided. But he's right that the Russian yeshiva don't know history. But that's if they knew the history, it wouldn't change it because they learned the history of Lithuania and Poland, and that this was not the approach of Lithuania and Poland. It was the approach of some of Germany, but it wasn't the approach of most of Germany. There was only, I think, four separatist gehillas in all of Germany. You had Frankfurt, you had Berlin, and Karlsruhe, I think, was one. And I believe you had one more. That's it. Most German Orthodox Jews, even Frankfurt, most German Orthodox Jews refused to go along with Hirsch. But Hungary was very successful. If you want to know where separatism succeeded in Hungary, it succeeded in Hungary. So then, what about with the Palestine? They wanted to bring it to Palestine. But it didn't work there either. You have a small group called the Eda Haredit. You had that before the state, you have it now. But look in Israel. Pretty much everyone is in one community, the Haredim. They fight. They do the same thing that, you know, when the Satmar said, how could you be in the Knesset? The response was, what's the difference? We were in the Polish parliament. You know, we have to fight for our rights. So this model of being in one, and when they're throwing bombs and when they're attacking us, there's great unity in the Jewish world, in the Haredim and the Chilonim in Israel. And that's, so what you see in Israel today is really following the Lithuanian and Polish model, that you're in one community, they're in one Knesset, you deal with the budget, you do things, you make deals when you can, and you fight while you can. The same fights that go on in the Knesset today between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox, these same fights went on in every Polish Jewish council and in the Vilna town council and all that. They fought about these things also. They once asked Rabbi Kahneman of Panevezh if he'd be in the Knesset. You know, they give a position. He could serve in the Knesset. He says he's not wealthy enough. What do you mean this? What do you mean not wealthy enough? He says, because sitting in Knesset, he'd hear such kafir every other day, he'd have to rip kriya. And he doesn't have enough money to buy all the clothes he'd need to sit in the Knesset and hear all the heresy that he'd have to be tearing kriya. But so that's that's the approach. But you can't expect a Hungarian rabbi who's been, that's his tradition. He's been indoctrinated into that to see anything positive. Now, the Aguda in America is of interest because they grab the bull by both horns, I guess you could say. Because on the one hand, if you look at the Aguda, they're involved in the president's conference, and they will cooperate and do things with all the Jewish organizations at a leadership level. Their people are not doing Auschwitz. They're cooperating with the leaders of other organizations. However, for the masses, they do adopt the approach of Auschwitz, of separatism. I mentioned this in previous years. If this was going to take us back to around 2003, I think, when they had the big rally and when the bombs were going off in Israel every other day, and there was that huge rally in Washington, D.C., and everyone was going. I'm sure there's plenty of people listening to us right now who were there. And Aguda was getting a lot of pressure from its wealthy Balabat team, and they brought it to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, and they said that the only way they can't agree, justification was, if they could control who the speakers were, then they would agree. But other than that, they won't. So they didn't go, as many Agudist types did go to that rally. And I know many were upset because, this was a time to show support for what was going on in Israel. But so the Aguda for the masses has like an Auschwitz type of perspective. Let's go on to the next tshuva. It is number 166, page 351. It's also to this Rabbi Jacobowitz. And I wanted to ask him a question. In the book, he speaks all about how terrible the status quo rabbis are. The status quo rabbis, you were not allowed to step foot in their shul. They were considered no different than a reform rabbi or a neolog, they call them there. If you were a shochet, they gave you like a real tshuva you had to do, if you were a rabbi, forget it, you could never get a position. They treated you just like if you were a religious Zionist. That is, just like the Hungarian, the Satmar, and the rest regarded religious Zionist rabbis, how they were unqualified or pasul, and you couldn't be led by them. That's the same as status quo rabbi. You could have a long beard and a bekesha. It didn't matter because he didn't join the organization. If you know some of the history, you know about Kloisenberg, for instance. Kloisenberg had one of the Gedolei Yisrael, the great-grandson of the Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Glasner. Moshe Shmuel Glasner, the Dor Ravi, but he was at Tziani, Rachmano Etzlan. So therefore, they had to separate from him, and it created a huge split. It's the same thing. The status quo rabbis were regarded just like the Zionists rabbis, just like the rabbi doctors. So I had a question. There was a great, great rabbi in Hungary. His name was Rameir Perlis. He's most people haven't heard of him. Let me see if we get a picture. I don't think so. I've never seen a picture of him. He's a great rabbi in Hungary. Everyone respected him. He was a leader of the, he went to the Pressburg Yeshiva. He dies in 1893, I see here. And I don't see a picture. A student of the Chasam Sofer. And he was, if you look at the early documents that against the reformers, he's, oh, you know what? I found it. I typed his name into Hebrew. So let me show you his picture. Oh, I'm very happy to find it. Here, Rav Meir Perlis. It says, Migdolei Rabbe Bnei Hungaria. The Rebbe of many of the rabbis of great rabbis of Hungary, the rabbi of the city of Krolla, which is a Satmar Rebbe city. And let me tell you, let's see if it tells what I asked about. Yep, here it is. He opposed the division of Hungary, and therefore he was persecuted, I guess you'd say, by the Hamon Am. By the masses. I've never heard that, by the way, that he was persecuted by the masses. My question was, if the status quo rabbis are so bad, and if you can't quote them, and if they're out of the fold, what about Rav Meir Perlis, who was one of the leaders of the opposition to the reform? But when push came to shove, he refused to separate his community. He wanted one community, and he didn't want to join the Orthodox organization, and his community remained status quo. And even when he's status quo, he has Talmidim, who are leaders of the Orthodox, still relate to him with kavod and all that. How can you make, Rabbi Jacobovitz, I said, how can you make such blanket judgments about the status quo when one of the Gedolei Torah of Hungary, Rav Meir Perlis, he was status quo? Good question. So he replies to me as follows. Interesting reply. He says, regarding what you're investigating about that Gadol, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, he says, take a look in volume one and you'll see how strongly he attacks the reformers. What happened afterwards? He says, there are many reasons that are known among us Hungarian Jews, and the elders know a lot, but they always refuse to speak about it. Just like I remember from my youth, he's talking about Hungary, when the elders, including my father, would speak about this great Gadol, what did they say? They would like sigh and say, Nebuch. Therefore, I am not going to put in print what I know, because Kavod Olkim Haster Davar. We should keep it hidden for the Kavod of this Gadol. But I will tell you one thing, that there were family reasons, and I won't say more than this. And I recommend to you, don't investigate this at all. Because they've in the past, they always refrain from speaking about it. That is, this needs to be covered up. Don't talk about it. What are the family? Well, there's a very large book about Hungarian Orthodox by Yosef Cohen. It's called Yadut Hungaria. And he also has a number of articles. And he revealed what this was. Lo and behold, and I mentioned this in a note, the Rav Meir Perlis had sons-in-law. I don't know how many sons-in-law, two, three, in the plural. None of them were Orthodox rabbis. And it is said that they influenced him not to join the Orthodox community. I don't know if these sons-in-law were neolog. That would be a real problem. Or if they were status quo. Whatever it is, that's the reason. Rav Meir Perlis, for family reasons, that's what Rabbi Jacobowitz was referring to. They didn't... He didn't feel like he could join an organization which was devoted to lambasting the non-Orthodox, be it the status quo or the neologues, when his own sons-in-law and his daughter was a Rebbetzin. Presumably, these were status quo rabbis. How could he join an organization which declares that the status quo rabbis are like reform rabbis, completely puzzle, when his own sons-in-law were status quo rabbis, and his own daughters were status quo Rebbetzins. I could see why you wouldn't want to do such a thing like that. The Rugachever had a son-in-law, the great Gaon. Unfortunately, he died young. His name was, he was in Petach Tikva, and his name escapes me now. He changed his name when he went to Israel. He's very close to Rav Kook. But the Rugachever attacked Rav Kook, and the Rugachever attacked all the religious Zionists, and he's a big Mizrahi rabbi. So how that worked, we don't know, but it's recorded that the Rugachever's daughter once wrote to her father, like trying to get him to stop these attacks on the Zionists because her husband is a Zionist rabbi. So that wouldn't make for good Shabbos dinner table conversation if the father-in-law is attacking the organization the son-in-law is involved with. That's Siman Shin Mem Chet. Sorry, Siman Kuf Samach Dal. Now we're up to page 349. No, sorry, we just did that. We're up to page 353, the second to last of the Tshuvot, number Kuf Samach Zayin. This is to a different individual. Now we're going to see a letter from, his name was Rav Dov Ber Schwartz. Unfortunately, he died during COVID. He lived in Williamsburg, Satmar Chassid. A number of them we know died. I hate to say it, but it's because many of them, it's because they just refused to accept that this was a real situation. Not all of them, some in the early stages, like everyone else. But as I said, unfortunately, he passed away because of COVID. He wrote two Sfarim. One of his Sfarim is this one. It's called Artzot HaChayim. It's Shem HaGadolim Gadoli Yisrael America. What it is, it's a list of all the Gadolim by alphabetically and all the Sfarim published in America and all the great rabbis who lived in America. Very, very helpful work. He makes mistakes. So, for instance, he doesn't know that the great rabbi Levi Ginsberg, who published the responsum on using grape juice, for Kiddush, he doesn't realize that that's not exactly an Orthodox figure. So that's, but it's other than that, it's very helpful. And I learned a lot from this book. It's a very good reference book. And I have to say that because it does not begin auspiciously. The very first page of the book has a mistake. And, that's a problem when literally the first page, what's the mistake? He's speaking about, actually not the first page, the first sentence of the book. When the first sentence of the book has a mistake, it's not the most auspicious. What's the first sentence? Well, he says, I'll read it to you. He goes, it was 500 years ago, 1492. One day after the beginning of the Inquisition in Spain, Christopher Columbus's ship, left to discover America. Well, the Inquisition did not start in 1492. The Inquisition, the approval was given in 1478, and the Inquisition was set up in 1480. So I don't know where he got this. What he explains here is it goes Hikdim HaKadosh Baruch Hu Rufuga Maka. Just as Spanish Jewry is going to be destroyed, God gives us somewhere else to go, namely America. But it's not true about the Inquisition. Another issue, which I'm sure he makes this mistake. Everyone makes this mistake in the Orthodox writers. You come on my Spain trip, you don't make it, is people don't know what the Inquisition is. A lot of people think that the Inquisition was against Jews, and they think Jews were persecuted by the Inquisition. Then, of course, if you ask them, well, I understand, then why was there an expulsion if there was an Inquisition destroying the Jews? The answer is the Inquisition had nothing to do with Jews. It had no authority about Jews. It was not directed against Jews. The Inquisition was directed against, Judaism was a legal religion in Spain until the expulsion. And you had many Jews there. Those were the ones who were expelled. The Inquisition is directed against the heretics. That is those Jews who convert to Christianity and then Judaize, as they call it, or were accused of Judaizing. And that's who the Inquisition is directed against. The only time the Inquisition ever had authority over Jews is if Jews would, let's say, provide kosher food or something, or circumcise. If a Jew would circumcise a Christian converso child, then that would fall under the jurisdiction of the Inquisition. But other than that, the Inquisition had nothing to do with Jews, didn't bother Jews, and people don't realize that generally. I want to show you one more thing now from this book. I say this, I know someone is going to email me afterwards. I shouldn't have said it because it could degrade Judaism, or it could bring Judaism into disrepute. Look, so much of Judaism be brought into disrepute by all sorts of people. You know, people have become irreligious and they reveal all sorts of stuff that maybe doesn't look good. I'm not the water carrier for Satmar or for anyone else. And I wrote about this on the Sfarim blog. So why not share it with you? And it doesn't reflect our values. And I think, but it, you should see it. I think it's worth seeing to know that unfortunately we have, there's some unfortunate opinions out there. And what I'm saying is not about the 19th century. You can have racists in the 19th century. We get that. But that someone will reprint it today. So prepare to be shocked. And disappointed that that this is. So here is a page from the book. Let's see. So here's, let's see, what page is it? Page 52, and deals with the different rabbis. He's dealing with this Rabbi Gewirtzman. I don't know. And let me just read it to you what it says here. At the bottom in the notes, you can read it on your own as well. It says, let's see, when the president of America, John Kennedy, Meshachrer HaKushim, I guess that we freer of the blacks, I guess because of civil rights, although really it's Lyndon Johnson, but he was also good, him and Bobby Kennedy, I guess. This Rabbi Gewirtzman recorded as follows, that at the time that Abraham Lincoln, the president of America, was assassinated, because he had ended slavery, the Shin of Arav said that this was a deserving punishment for Abraham Lincoln. Why? Because he went against the curse, Arur Kanan Eved Yehudim, that so-called Ham's curse, which, by the way, was the religious justification for slavery. It was the religious justification for apartheid. The idea that the descendants of Ham, the Hamitic peoples, that's the blacks. Of course, I wonder, do any people who ever felt that when anesthesia was invented, did they feel that then women could not take anesthesia when they gave birth because there's a curse? In pain, you shall give birth? Or how about, does that mean a man, you couldn't use a tractor? Because, is a curse destiny? Or is a curse that you can't get over it? Or, I mean, it's very strange. And then it says, Kol Mishin, anyone who tries to do like this, that is to be in favor of civil rights, his ending will be the same. And that's why Kennedy was killed, because he was good to the blacks, just like Lincoln. I mean, is this the most, it's hard not to be disgusted when you hear this, but what can I tell you? I'm not going to cover it up. If it's out there, this is what some people think, unfortunately. And we do have a problem of racism in certain parts of our community. The whole thing of the Ham's curse, a lot has been written about this, but leaving that aside, it's a very helpful book. And I just wish that this passage was not there, because it's real disgrace. So what does this have to do with my question, Hungary? Well, because at the title of the title of the responsum is to is involving oneself with the Torah of the status quo rabbis, and also more about Meir Prohus. Generally, the assumption in the Hungarian Orthodox world is that status quo rabbis are pasul, off the table, can't have any involvement with them at all. I'm going to show you something that I showed you before, but I didn't reveal it was a status quo rabbi. You might remember, I showed you this sefer. It's like the first Steinsaltz. It's the, it's called Hamadrich. And hold on, where's my paper here? It's written by two brothers, one Avram Singer, he's a rabbi, and his brother. What you don't know here is that this Avraham Singer was a status quo rabbi. Now, this is a, I showed you already, this is a, hold on a second, I want to show you the approbations to this book. Oh, why is it? Okay, so here's, it's like a Steinsaltz. It has the Rashi, it has the Gemara, it has an easy explanation. He took a commentary from Rashi and made it into a, you know, it's like Steinsaltz uses Rashi. So this book has more approbations. I think he realized it would be controversial, because what are you doing? You're taking the Talmud and making it easier. So he has like 30 approbations from all the different rabbis. However, they're all rabbis from Poland and Lithuania. When it comes to and Germany also, look who, let me show you who the rabbis of Germany. Of the German rabbis, look. Both Rabbi Hirsch, Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, and Israel Hildesheimer. Rabbi Ador from London, and then many rabbis, Gedolim, from everywhere, from the land of Israel, Sephardic rabbis, which rules a lot. It goes on and on, the greatest Rabbonim, because if you look at these other rabbis, they didn't care, the Netziv. I mean, this whole thing of status quo, they thought this was Hungarian Mishigas. If you look, though, at the Hungarian, he does have Hungarian rabbis, just two. One is, as you could expect, Remeir Perlis, and the other is a Rabbi Weinberger. Now, this Rabbi Weinberger was actually forced to come out with a public statement retracting his haskama. And a letter from about 45 different Hungarian rabbis came out condemning this work, Hamadrich, because the status quo rabbi. And that's the way Hungarian Orthodox generally regarded the status quo rabbis. So my question was, however, because in this book, in the back there, he has letters between him and other rabbis. And there's a rabbi, he lived in Borough Park, I think it was Borough Park, not Flatbush, Avram Meir Israel. And he was a Hungarian rabbi, and he wrote a sefer called Vayan Avraham. I can tell you, he's an interesting character. I once called his house to try to get the book. I didn't speak to him. He wasn't well, but I spoke to one of his children. But subsequently, I've learned he used to write for Sinai, the religious Zionist periodical, under a pseudonym. So we're not dealing with a typical Hungarian, although he's Hungarian Rav. Was it Sinai? Yeah, Sinai, I believe, or Mizrach, one of them. He was asked by Rabbi Schwartz, are you allowed to study the writings of the status quo rabbis? And if you look in his volume, number 43, he actually says that you can. He says the only isser was to, you can't ask, they can't be the rav of your community. You can't ask them shilas, but you can study their writings. That is, what was the isser? Shalol kabaharateyam. That was the isser, but the Torah Tam, the Torah, you could study. And he goes all through it. He says that, he makes this distinction, which is really not a Hungarian distinction. He makes it up on himself. If you look at all the Hungarian rabbis, they don't make this distinction. He assumes, however, that it's okay to involve yourself in the Torah of a status quo rabbi. You just can't, they can't be the rub of your community or anything like that. So then I wrote to Rabbi Schwartz, and I wanted to get an understanding of this because he cites Rabbi Israel, cites Remeir Perlis as a perfect example. If you look at Remeir Perlis, his Talmidim would still write to him. So even though he's status quo. So I wrote to Rabbi Schwartz. I was sort of trying to be maybe mischievous. I wrote to him saying, but you can't bring a proof from Remeir Perlis because Remeir Perlis is a separate case. He's one of the Gedolei Yisrael, and he was the Rebbe of all these rabbis in Hungary. What are they supposed to do, reject their Rebbe? So I wanted to say that, I was trying to basically put him on the spot. How can he conclude this, that you can, and what's going on here? Why would he write? Why would he think of even asking this question? And he explains it to me. He says that the reason was because he was actually, someone came to hire him to prepare for publication one of the volumes of the status quo rabbis, the Chidushim. And he wanted to know, well, could I do that? Because we know that the status quo rabbis were posseled. They were made no difference. Kira b'nei. Instead of rabbanei, resh ayin, ra, then b'nei. Hanilogim. They're no different than hanilogims. And just like the Maharam Shik said, so therefore I had a question. Could I do this or not? So then he wrote, that's why he wrote to this rabbi. And then he says to me, it's very interesting. He says that what I said, that Rav Meir Perlis is a separate case, he says, the rabbis, they did not give their words to Lishirim. They didn't make these distinctions. If you're going to tell me, he's the liberal now. He's saying, if you're going to tell me that you can learn the Torah of Meir Perlis, then you can learn the Torah of any status quo rabbi. And he says that Remeir Perlis was well respected by all of them, and that's why he asked the question from the Gedolim, and they gave their opinion. And the opinion was this rabbi that I you could involve yourself with the Torah of the status quo rabbi, which, as I said, it's really shocking because if the status quo rabbis aren't the new old rabbis are completely puzzled, well, why can you learn the Torah? On the contrary, you can't learn the Torah. That's what they all said. Had he asked a different rabbi, not this Avraham Meir Israel, who was an academic scholar, a shtickle, things like that, he would have got a different answer. We are now up to, and normally we stop now, but I'm going to go because I want to finish the book itself tonight. And then we'll have the appendix for next class. Maybe I think I'll take two classes of the appendix. Maybe one, but I think two. And then, as I said, I want to do letters that were not included. And this is a letter also getting back to Ben-Zvi and Jacobowitz. He has two volumes of German of Hungarian Orthodoxy, and he doesn't deal with a man named Rav Shlomo Zvi Schick. Let me show you what he looks like from the Maharam Schick's family. Here he is. I found a picture. That's him in the middle. And those are his sons. And his son-in-law, Meir Stein. This one here, I guess, Rav Berechia Schick, he was the father of Rabbi Alexander Schick, who I mentioned, who was the rabbi of Rabbi Brechschel, the Yorkville Synagogue. And the Schick family, I spoke to Rabbi Alexander Schick. He gave me two letters. He went to the Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin. And he gave me two letters he got from Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg. He told me he sent his son to Lakewood. He reprinted their grandfather's writings. This Rav Shlomo Zvi Schick was really out of place. He was a German Orthodox type rabbi who was stuck in Hungary. He was a defender of the status quo. And he took a trip to Eretz Yisrael when Rav Kook was in Yafo with a whole group from his city, Karzig, in Hungary. And they met Rav Kook. Adam Furziger wrote his master's dissertation at Yeshiva University on him. He has two volumes of Tshuvot, Shelot Tshuvot Rashban. And then he has five volumes, Torah Shlema, it's called, on the Torah. He has Takanot Tfilot on davening. He has probably 15 different books. He has one called Mimosha Ad Moshe, which is about the history of his relative, the Maharam Schick. So lots of very interesting, unusual stuff. But because he stood up for the status quo rabbis and he refused to go along, even though he himself, his community was Orthodox, but he refused to go along with the putting them in Chayrim, he was basically put in Chayrim. The only people who ever would quote his writings are rabbis outside of Hungary. If you look in the people he's corresponding with in his Tshuvot, he's only corresponding with status quo rabbis and non-Hungarian rabbis. So I wanted to know about him. Why Rabbi Jacobowitz? Tell me something about Rabbi Shlomo Zvi Schick. Why don't you deal with him? And look what he says. Regarding this rabbi, he won't even mention his name, that you asked me about. And I wrote in my email, my letter to him, there's no email, this is 1989, I said, you didn't write about this rabbi, Rabbi Shlomo Zvi Schick, that many rabbis opposed him. He says, "Hineni omer befem mele shelo harbe rabbanim itnagduo, ela kol rabbanei Ungarn." He says, don't say that most of the rabbis opposed him, rather all the rabbis opposed him. He's probably right that all the Orthodox rabbis opposed him in Hungary, why? Because who yatsa min hakol? He left the Orthodox group and his whole point was to join together with the Neologues. He was opposed to all separatism and he constantly spoke about the need to be unified. That's even though his community was Orthodox. And then he says, in the end, yatsa min hakol Orthodox, in the end, they left Orthodoxy and he made his community Neologue. That is Motzi Shemra. Absolutely false. His community never became Neologue. His community never became status quo. His community remained Orthodox. Although what does it mean to be Orthodox? Orthodox just means you follow the Orthodox prohibitions, the nine things you can't do, and also you pay your dues and you're associated with it. But he was always, and he's the rabbi. He's not the community. He's paid by the community. The community was Orthodox. And they liked him. But he never spoke, as far as I know, about getting rid of Orthodox communities. What he said is that those rabbis who don't join the Orthodox, the status quo, we still need to treat them like with respect and that sort of thing. He was the rabbi in Kartsug. They called him the Kartsuger. Incidentally, I'll tell you about another community that was status quo, Debrecen. We all know Rav Moshe Stern, the Debrecener Rav. that was the Orthodox community, but the separatist community, but the main community in Debrecen was status quo. And then he says that they would do stuff with the flour to make it for Pesach in this city, Kartsug. But what did they know? When you went to Kartsug, you did not stay overnight there. You didn't want to, you went there, you did what you have to do, and you left, because Chas v'Shalom to stay overnight in that city that has the Rav, like, he's even worse than the status quo, because he's an Orthodox rabbi who's defending the status quo. We all know that it's always worse if you're one of the group and you're not 100% loyal. And that's the final tshuva. There's a lot more. If God willing, we'll return to Hungary, and we'll talk lots. You'll come on my trip if you want. Some of you have already been. We'll talk all about the Hungarian situation, and we'll see these sites, and we can reflect on it. With this, we have finished the book, class 49 of the tshuva, the section. And wasn't sure how long it would take. I told you this already. I'm happy to see, though, that it's been popular. If you look online, the first class, if you look on YouTube, has like 1967 or 68. Almost by the end of the week, we'll have 2,000 hits. That's a lot. And many, many thousands of hits for these classes. You need people watching on YouTube as well as the people listening. What I want to do, though, I'll get to the questions in a minute. I'm not done. Because next class, as an appendix, we have correspondence of 20 years. It's about, 10 pages between me and Yonah Emanuel. And I'll explain to you who Yonah Emanuel is next week. Discussing all sorts of interesting things that were happening in the Jewish world. Rabbi Schlichlech of Weinberg, Rav Soloveitchik. I have excerpts of letters that he wrote to me. And it really takes us back 20 and 30 years ago into the religious life in the land of Israel. And I'll tell you about this fascinating individual, Yonah Emanuel, a great, great Talmud Chacham who worked for a living. I remember when he edited the journal Hamayan, when I first wrote to him to subscribe to it, I addressed him as Rabbi Yonah Emanuel. And he wrote back to me and says, "I'm not a rabbi." He says, "Ani osek b'yishuvo shalom." He makes a living. He owned the, remember in Israel, up at the court top of King George, there used to be an optician. I forgot the first, something et Emmanuel. It was two partners, but right at the top, next to where Richie's was, if you remember Richie's, for those years ago, pizza, right at that, when you get to the top of the street of King George, he was an optician, a survivor. Well, I'll give you the whole story and why these letters are of such interest as well. We'll talk about the Rav Soloveitchik's funeral, well, lots of stuff, the Meiri. But so that'll probably take us two classes, I think. So we're not done yet. Even though we're done, the section dealing with halacha, machshava, history. Someone today wrote me an email from Israel. My son has copies of the book, and he was at Shabbos lunch with Yechiel Goldhaber a few weeks ago. And this guy from the Mir was there. No, not there, sorry, from Brisk was there. And he wanted the book because he saw it at Yechiel's house. So my son got him the copy of the book a couple days ago. So he wrote to me and how much he enjoyed it. And he said, where else do you find a book that has so many different areas in it? So I thank him for saying that because it did have a lot. And we're not done. So let me not end yet. Let me just take the questions and the comments. Baruch says, not just bride and groom. No, it's just the bride and groom, Baruch. The mitzvah tanz is only the bride and groom. My point was that people don't realize sometimes when you say that you could tell people, you know, at some Hasidic weddings, not all Hasidim, but many Hasidic weddings, you have mixed dancing. And they say, impossible. What do you mean? And you can say, not by everyone, but just by the bride and groom. Like, but they still won't believe you, many people. But you do have it. And we just saw it. Hyman says the complaint does not really claim that the place is not kosher. The claim is the hechsher given by someone who is related to the owner of one of the owners. The relevant people claim it isn't even true, so it's liable and commercial tort. To my knowledge, having a financial interest in an establishment is not a per se disqualification of mashkiach. It doesn't seem to be disqualification for the OU. After all, in Europe, you ate at the inn because you trusted the innkeeper. Yes, but also the thing is, in Europe, Hyman, for example, you had a rav of a community. No one else could come in and give a hashkacha. even if it doesn't matter if it's reliable, because the idea was that the rabbi gives a shkacha. Now, once you have big cities, that falls down, because obviously in a big city, you're going to have different people. And in America, many people believe in free enterprise. And if someone, and they claim this new shkacha called Sof Mahadran, they claim to be more stringent. And I already said that it's a bit of a problem, because if it was Satmar, let's say there's a Satmar community like you have in Staten Island, if they have their own Ashkacha, no one's going to say anything. But this is directed to the same people. And in Europe, this never would be allowed. And it has nothing to do with reliability. It has to do with the fact that you want to have one Ashkacha. That's a value, because you know, then you have one standard. The question is, though, can you, if you then tell people don't eat there because it's undermining the Vod, I don't see how that's a violation. It's a monopoly, you know, that you could say that's religious. You know, the idea that we want to have one Vod, that has religious value. It could be a claim, I think, in Beistin, though, because if you do imply that it's not reliable Hashkacha, then, you know, it could be Motzi Shemra. But if you're upfront and you simply say it's just about procedure, we don't want to support others, it would be hard to make the case that... But the Five Towns is so big now. The 53 rabbis signed this letter saying don't eat there. And all these 53 rabbis are being brought to Beis Din, or now to court. I don't see how they have a case, though. Baruch, the Kohanim, what I'm told, the Kohanim who go to the Rebbe's Kever, it's set up in a way that they're not mitame. But the Chabad does not hold, and the Rebbe already established this with the Rayatz, that you don't say that because the Rebbe is such a tzaddik that a Kohen can just step on the kever. On the contrary, they set it up in such a way that he doesn't. Rabbi Barry, Rabbi Hartman says that Rabbi Mel Schechter, father of Herschel, told us about this topic and said he was uncertain whether Hungarian Orthodox rabbi can be Mesader Kiddushin today in a shul. Well, that's because they had a decree. Rav Moshe says that Rav Moshe doesn't think that this is a real decree. He thinks it's only because of the battle against the reformers. But the Hungarians don't think that. They think it still applies even today. Let me take that back. The Hungarian Orthodox. Plenty of Hungarian Orthodox who came to America, though, said, agreed with Rav Moshe that today it's not really that relevant. If you, Schneer Lyman, if you listen to his, it's on YU Torah. He gave, before he went to Hungary. So I listened to his talks, that there are people as they go to sites, they have a tape recorder and he'd speak about the different sites. So right when they're outside the Dohani show, he's speaking about the Dohani synagogue there. And he says, now, except for Hungarian Orthodox, we're going in, because Hungarian Orthodox had a cherem. You couldn't step foot in that. It is no difference in Frankfurt, incidentally. You can't go there anymore. Mordechai Horowitz, the Matalevi show, because it was destroyed in Kristallnacht. You can go to the place in Frankfurt and they have a model like on the ground. You could see where it was. But in the Frankfurt community, you were forbidden to step foot in that shul. It was not allowed. So, yes, I don't know. It's whether Hungarian Orthodox to be Messiah. But incidentally, Rav Soloveitchik was not so crazy about being Messiah Kedushin in a shul. He did it. And I think Rav Dov Lifshitz also. What Mike sends out, the Hasidic rabbi attacked by adversaries in Lemberg. I don't know what that is. Send it to me offline. I'll look at it later. Yes, Yisrael. Thank you, David. Yisrael Abba Citron. Citron is his Israeli name. He had another name. The famous case I speak about in the book on Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg, where Rabbi Weinberg gets into this big machokas of the Rebbetzin, but the Yibam case deals with Rabbi Citron. Rabbi Citron and his wife did not have children, and he died, and they had to do Yibam. The problem was he had two brothers. One was a communist in Soviet Union, and the other was like a complete atheist he had converted to Christianity, as I recall, and he was living in... forget the details. He was living in Germany. And the question was, which brother should you use? And Rabbi Weinberg had a big machokas about this with the rugged shover. Ellen says, in the early days, there was questions about anesthesia and childbirth. Queen Victoria made it kosher. There were questions about the Sri Deish deals with it also, about anesthesia with a bris milah. I think today we all assume that it's okay, at least localized. But there were people, I think it's Rabbi Meir Arik, if I'm not mistaken, Imre Yosher, who claims that you can't use anesthesia on a kid because just like Avraham Avinu felt it with pain, so too all the children need to feel it with pain. And the response to this was, is who says? Who says? Just because Avraham Avinu had pain that we have to have pain now. If we can get rid of the pain, let's get rid of the pain. Just like we can get rid of the pain with anesthesia and childbirth. Rabbi Kelman, if you can just email that to me, I'll... you know what, instead of emailing it to me, I will simply, while we're speaking here, as I'm going down, I'm going to make myself a note here, what Rabbi Kelman sent me, and what Mike sends me, so I will be able to respond properly, because when I log out, I don't have access to this anymore, but now we're set. I just said it to myself. Okay, let's continue with questions here. Someone privately says the Orthodox community accepted the tshuva on grape juice written by Ginsberg, but didn't accept the tshuva on swordfish, which says more about how the Orthodox community changed over the decades, not the quality of the tshuva. Yeah, the swordfish tshuva was done by Rabbi, now the author of the Code of Jewish Law.
Klein in Buffalo.
Yeah, Isaac Klein from Buffalo. And before that, Springfield, Rabbi Lamb and him shared the same synagogue. All I would say to that, to the private person, is that the Orthodox community in America did eat swordfish. I showed in an earlier class the Agudas Rabbanim list of kosher fish, and swordfish is on there. Rabbi Zivotofsky has an article showing how swordfish became non-kosher, and the credit or the blame is Rabbi Tendler. Rabbi Tendler is the reason that swordfish became non-kosher. He made it a cause celeb for himself, and he pushed this matter. And both Rabbi Tendler and Rabbi Klein used the same information from the one swordfish expert in America at the Museum of Natural History. And if the way it's described by Rabbi Zivotofsky, they each asked different questions, but none of them had seen a swordfish. Rabbi Zivotofsky is the first rabbi. I shouldn't say that, Rabbi Savitsky, actually, he declared swordfish a kosher. He went to the Boston Harbor. But Rabbi Zivotofsky actually took a swordfish. He got a swordfish. He bought it. And he showed it to Rav Schechter. And then he showed it to Rav Machpud in Israel, a different swordfish they got.
I believe that it was based on Yecheskel Landau's tshuva.
That deals with sturgeon. That deals with sturgeon. It's the same idea, basically. But the swordfish already is mentioned by the Knesset Sagola, Rabben Venisti. He talks about the Dag HaCherev. So there are places that they used to eat the Dag HaCherev. And Rav Soloveitchik said swordfish is kosher. But we don't need ancient history. This takes us back, I think, to the third or fourth class. You remember? I showed you the article. Rav Schechter holds today, halacha l'maisa, you could eat swordfish. If you want to go to the store and buy swordfish, Rav Schechter holds it's permissible.
But it was, of course, it was taken down.
They took down from the Jewish Press's article. But if you ask him, he'll tell you it's kosher. He's been saying this for years because the Roth held it's kosher. Rabbi Savitsky, I confirmed this with his son, in his Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, he got up into this whole community and said that swordfish is kosher. And as the Rebbetzin said, but you can't bring it in the house. She wouldn't allow it. It's a machlokas swordfish. The question I raised when I dealt with Rav Schechter is I think swordfish today is so unkosher in America that even though Rav Schechter is like the post-sake of America, he's the halach authority for the OU. My question, I emailed one of the big rabbis down in Florida, head of one of the big VODs. I said, so now are you going to start serving swordfish in your restaurant? And the answer is no. Because even though Rav Schechter is the post-sake for all these VODs, the people won't accept it. If you started serving swordfish, the people won't accept it. It's for whatever reason, the minhag is not to eat it. And I don't know if you could really bring it back. So Baruch says, mitzvah tants is not just the term used for bride and groom. Other families participate soon. When I'm speaking about where they hold touch, where they hold hands, I'm not talking about like where they hold, where, for example, they are in a circle of some sort holding on to the rope or the handkerchief or something, or if a man is touching a man. And I'm talking about when bride and groom are mixed dancing. That's what I'm referring to. You don't have any other people doing that. The one exception is, if you recall, Baruch, I showed you from the Carlin Stolen wedding, where you had the Rebbe, you had the son, you had the bride, and you had the mechutan, and they were all dancing in one circle. which is a bit strange. And finally, David Eisen says, Yonah Emanuel's optical store was called Udman et Emanuel. Oman and Emmanuel, and today is just Oman. Yes, okay. So we will talk next class. I don't know what Victoria Day is, if that's today. So,
I wish you lessons. Oh my gosh, I thought today's legal holiday in Canada today. Victoria, you know, Victorian age. So
But I didn't know.
You're a revolutionary. So what do we expect?
We fought a war to remove ourselves.
We peacefully, the British North America Act.
So we'll see you next week. Before Rabbi Kalman, class number 50. It's a very auspicious day. 50 is it's
Yovel.
Yes, Yovel.
So, once in a Yovel, that's it. Baruch Hashem. Okay, we look
at some of these faces have been with me since the first one, so it's a big achievement.
Yes, okay, Rabbi Kalman, really, Yeshikoach, doctor, for a wonderful year of classes. This was really a fill in because of COVID that Mark's Dr. Shapir said it was hard to, you know, he didn't have access to all his books and research. Everything was locked down. We're talking a year ago. So he'll talk about his book for a few weeks until, you know, things calm down. And here we are a year later. But that's how the best things work out. So very good. We look forward to whatever, 2, 3, 4 weeks, however long it takes to finish. Then we'll move on to Shaul Lieberman. And then we'll figure out who's after Shaul Lieberman. But or maybe another book. But anyways, thank you very much. We look forward to next week.
My teachers, Shaul Lieberman and Jose Faur. Aleichem Shalom.
Okay.
They'll be mentioned. They'll both get a mention.
Yes. Okay. All right. Tomorrow we're off. We're sort of in between semesters or whatever words you want to use. So no class tomorrow. But we are, Marty Lakshman's class will continue Wednesday morning at 11 a.m. and Dr. Sokolov, the Haftorah. So we'll be back both on Wednesday and Thursday, just the Parsha Shir, and Friday, the Pirkei Avot Shir. And then we'll be sending out in the next day or two some of our upcoming programs that we're in the middle of working on. And that's it. Mark, they want to know, do you know about Canadian football?
Hold on, one more thing before we end. Someone privately emails me that it's also okay for a father to hold his daughter's hand. I think I showed you the video of Mordechai Ben David doing this with his granddaughter. Okay, so that's also, I guess, for the mitzvah tants. But then I worked at a hotel. I was a waiter. And I think I told you the story that I went back and told my Rebbe, Rebbe Parnas, or Parnas from YU's son. I was shocked when I saw that for the first time. And he said, it's an old issue that the Litvakin had with the Hasidim. I was, because I had never heard of such a thing like this. And the Litvish never did it. It was only the Hasidim who did it. This was at the Shalimar Catering Hall in Staten Island, if anyone remembers the Shalimar. And okay.
By the way, you mentioned Rabbi Tendler. I understand he needs a refuah shlema. I got a couple emails like today that he's in intensive care, and we should wish him a refuah shlema. And it was Ari Zivotofsky gave that talk, I guess, on Shabbos. I just looked for it on the Torah Motion. I couldn't find it. I think he gave that talk in Toronto on Shabbos about the history of swordfish, how, it used to be a kosher animal. In the 1930s, the Agudas HaRabbanim had it on the list of kosher animals. And today, it's identified with the conservative movement. That's why, because they were matirit, so that became like part of the battle.
He has great articles. I can send anyone Zivotofsky's article, and you can send it.
It's in Hebrew, though. The article's in Hebrew.
It's in English. It was on
Maybe there are two articles. I don't even know if I have the English one. You can send me the English one. Yeah. I have the Hebrew one.
It's like a 40-page article. And at his halachic suda, which was done under the hashkacha of the Rabbanut of Jerusalem, they served swordfish. And you could see a picture online of the giant swordfish. So there you go.
Yes, I understand. It's Moshe David Ben Bela. That's about what I understand. What I got out of it's with the A, I, or E, or whatever the spelling. But yes, that is the name. So it's had a refuah shlema. We should all be well and hear good news. Besorot tovot to everybody.
In fact, I'm going to be dealing with Rabbi Tendler in this series coming up soon. We should have him for him. Okay, thank you, everyone.
Okay, everybody, be well. Lila Tov. Look forward to seeing you Wednesday and invite your friends and all good things. Okay, Lila Tov, everybody. And Boker Tov in Israel.